that is going to be a real push and pull going forward for the Democratic Party as it tries to reorient itself for this new political landscape that the country finds itself in.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, the election and what comes next in the Empire State. Election day was not a pretty picture for Democrats nationally, but there were some bright spots in New York State, where they flipped some key House seats and kept control in Albany ahead of the next state legislative session. At the same time, New York Republicans have plenty to be happy about after the election result. Some of them are heading to Washington to join the second Trump administration. For a breakdown of what it all means, we called up Politico's Nick Reisman. So, Nick, obviously there was a lot of focus on New York State in the elections, and that was actually a rare bright spot in some ways for the Democratic Party on otherwise a really bad night. How did Democrats do in their efforts in New York State this time around?
Well, the big headline for New York Democrats is that the party was able to flip three House seats, one in the Syracuse area in central New York, that's John Manion defeating Brandon Williams. In the Hudson Valley, Mark Molinaro, the Republican incumbent there, is apparently defeated by Democrat Josh Riley. And on Long Island, Laura Gillen, the Democratic challenger, was able to unseat Republican freshman Anthony D'Esposito. At the same time, the Democrats were able to hold a couple of swing districts, including Tom Suozzi's seat on Long Island, as well as Pat Ryan's in the Hudson Valley, kind of the New York City exurban area as well. So while Democrats clearly struggled nationally, they have a good story to tell in parts of New York, winning these pivotal House seats. This comes at 2 years after Democrats in New York were largely blamed for the party losing control of the House because of the red wave not necessarily materializing across the country, but in some of those crucial New York suburban swing districts.
Do you think Governor Hochul bolstered her own standing due to the amount of resources that she focused on those congressional races?
I think she certainly hopes so. Keep in mind, Governor Hochul has her own reelection to start thinking about in 2 years' time. What the governor did this time was she really built out the organizational muscle, the political infrastructure of the state Democratic Committee, something that really hadn't been done before under previous governors. You know, the state Democratic Committee kind of largely historically has existed to serve the political needs and political will of whomever was governor at the time. And this was really the first time that a lot of those resources and energy and attention and focus has been turned away from the governor and on some of these down ballot House races. So there were thousands of volunteers, paid staff, dozens of field offices that were open. This is something that the governor's political team was very proud of. And certainly this gamble of trying to essentially make her the key figure in this effort to retake the House paid off. Now she's got some friends in the House who could say that, well, at the very least, she didn't hurt them when she helped them with this effort. And she can also use this infrastructure in her own reelection bid as well.
But at the same time, it looks pretty likely as we speak that Chuck Schumer will trade the majority for the minority and Hakeem Jeffries will not be the next speaker. So did New York give up any clout based on the outcome of this election?
Of course, incoming President Donald Trump, the president-elect, is a New York native. That is not something that's too much to sneeze at, but it's going to be interesting to see what certain policy outcomes are going to be coming as a result of this. For instance, Governor Hochul is moving to potentially reinstitute congestion pricing. That was the controversial toll plan for entering parts of Manhattan at the peak hour. I think the peak toll was going to be $15 an hour. She has subsequently reached out to federal officials to see if they can lower that toll down to $9 without having some sort of lengthy environmental review that my colleagues at Politico reported exclusively last week. So Trump may be able to either stop that or reverse that. I know a number of Republican members of the House would like to see him take some sort of administrative step to block New York from instituting congestion pricing. But there are a variety of other major issues, major infrastructure projects that New York is going to get is going to need federal money for, that Trump will largely be instrumental in determining whether it actually happens.
So how much stock do you put in the Hochul-Trump phone call? Obviously, they're political foils to a degree, but there's a new reality. And apparently that call happened right around the same time that Hochul and Tish James, the attorney general, held a press conference to say rights of New Yorkers would be protected in a second Trump White House.
I think you're going to start to see, and that press conference was really the start of it, you're going to see a push and pull within the Democratic Party over the next couple of months or so as the party tries to sort out what it needs to do next after the wreckage of last week's election day. On the one hand, you're going to have a number of Democrats who will try to revive the resistance, do the resistance 2.0, the kind of energized, progressive political activity that we saw in the wake of Trump's first win in 2016. And you're also going to see some folks, perhaps more toward the center, moderate view of politics, like, say, what Governor Hochul has. And they are going to have to walk this tightrope of saying, well, I will work with President Trump when I deem it necessary to work with President Trump. And on areas where I vehemently disagree with the new president on certain issues, such as deportations, that is going to be a real push and pull going forward for the Democratic Party as it tries to reorient itself for this new political landscape that the country finds itself in.
Let's talk about somebody who placed a big bet and won, and that is Northern New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. She now, as we know, is in line to become the next UN ambassador, and she has been one of Trump's fiercest allies in the House of Representatives after, at one point, being a Trump skeptic. Things are really looking up for her, obviously.
Right. Elise Stefanik, I've been covering her for about 10 years now, and it is very interesting to see her evolution as a member of Congress, someone who started off as a Paul Ryan advisor and someone who had worked with Paul Ryan, and now certainly is someone who falls into the category of staunch Trump supporter. And she has distinguished herself as someone who is vehemently supportive of Trump. And during the first impeachment trial, she kind of rose to prominence as someone who, from the congressional lectern, was willing to stridently defend the president against his critics. And during the election as well, proved to be a voice that I think Trump needed with younger women, which he clearly, that was a demographic that he had been struggling with during much of the campaign. Keep in mind also, you know, her performance during a House hearing earlier this year, where she excoriated Ivy League college presidents over their handling of demonstrations on campuses in the wake of the Israel-Gaza war, I think also brought some new attention to Stefanik on the international level as well. So that is a very interesting appointment for Stefanik. She perhaps does not have a lot of foreign policy experience, but this is where she gains that foreign policy experience. And now she could potentially go on to even bigger jobs after this UN ambassadorship is up.
So you and I were just young pups spell checking Skaza Fava when there was a special election for that district years and years ago, right after Barack Obama became president and tapped the then Congressman John McHugh. And that left open a chance for Democrats to win a seat that they hadn't had in 200 years. Do you see New York 21 as being a possible pickup for Democrats in a special election, or is Trumpism and Stefanikism here to stay in the North Country?
Well, this is a district, Ian, as you well know, it's huge geographically. It runs from the Albany exurbs all the way up to the Canadian border. It's got the Adirondack Mountains. It's got Fort Drum. It is, I've always thought of it, and I've lived there for a couple of years, I've always thought of it as kind of a libertarian-esque district in many respects. You have a very large rural population, and they are obviously very skeptical of regulations and centralized power on down the list. This has been Trump country for the last 8 years or so. I don't suspect that will change. You do have some Republicans who are already starting to jockey to replace Elise Stefanik. It's going to be a tough nut for Democrats to crack. She was able to hold on to that seat for 10 years, and after flipping it following Owens's retirement in 2014, it's really never come close to falling back into the Democratic column. So, who knows? You could see Democrats potentially try to start to test run some of their future messaging in this special election. Even if they don't catch lightning in a bottle, I would not be surprised if you start to see Democrats test, well, does this moderate message, does this centrist message work with voters who are concerned about inflation, who are concerned about border security? So that will be perhaps the biggest thing that comes out of this. But who knows? It's probably not going to be held until April at the earliest, and that's a lifetime away in politics, as we know.
Sure is. Okay, so another thing that's on the horizon is the legislative session in Albany in the beginning of January. Were there any results from election night that stood out to you or might change the way things go with the Democratic majority in the state legislature?
Status quo. Everything more or less is staying the same in Albany. I think the dynamic with the legislature, which is dominated by Democrats, and Governor Hochul is going to largely remain the same. One of the more interesting and potential points of contention that we're going to see next year is the governor's effort to overhaul how school districts are funded. The foundation formula is potentially going to be changed, and that could be a big political fight, especially for Democrats who represent Long Island and Hudson Valley school districts, where they get a lot of state funding, and they may not be happy to see their school districts coming up short in a formula change.
You know, one person we didn't talk about at all was somebody who was on the ballot that day, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She won re-election, but she'll be going back to a Senate where she's in the minority, at least for the start of this 6-year term. What kind of profile do you expect her to have in the new year?
There's been some reporting that Kirsten Gillibrand might be up for the chairship of the Senate Democrats' fundraising arm. That would give her certainly a very important perch nationally if she were to get something like that. And she would probably be up there in terms of national Democrats alongside the new incoming minority leader, Chuck Schumer, in terms of Democratic importance, especially as the party tries to win back control of the US Senate, which is going to be tricky. I mean, a lot of these senators who lost in these red states, I'm thinking Sherrod Brown in Ohio, that's a tough environment. If somebody like Sherrod Brown loses in a presidential year, that's going to be tough. But at the same time, you also saw some Democrats outrunning their top of the ticket. I'm thinking Ruben Gallego in Arizona. So there is a model potentially for Democrats at the Senate level to follow. Whether Gillibrand is going to be part of that remains to be seen.
So, Nick, one thing that passed on Election Day in New York State was the Equal Rights Amendment, which had kind of fierce supporters and detractors. And this is effectively a response to the Roe versus Wade overturning by the Supreme Court, although the language very famously does not use the word abortion. In the end, voters went for it. How come?
I think ultimately you saw about 56, 57% of voters pass the Equal Rights Amendment. This was something that I think a number of supporters of the amendment thought would pass by a lot wider of a margin than it ultimately did. It did outrun the top of the ticket. I believe Kamala Harris got about 54% of the vote in New York, give or take. At the end of the day, though, a number of consultants who were involved in this effort thought that this was going to get into the 60s, if not 70%, because the thinking is a number of independents and even Republican voters will cross over and support something like this, especially if it is about enshrining reproductive rights in the New York State Constitution. However, there has been a pretty aggressive pushback against that amendment, kind of suggesting that all manner of things could occur, either leaning into some of the anti-trans rhetoric that we've seen on the national stage, suggesting that there would be non-citizen voting as a result of this, seizing on national origin protections in that amendment that you alluded to. So this did not pass by such a healthy margin that Democrats are necessarily clapping themselves on the back with this, but it was an accomplishment in that it's now done. It was just not the turnout vehicle that Democrats had initially hoped it was going to be.
So let's wrap up by, and forgive me, everybody, looking ahead to the next election in New York State. You know, I think it's not a secret that Hudson Valley Republican Congressman Mike Lawler is looking at running for governor. And Democrats were hoping to unseat him on Tuesday with Mondaire Jones. That did not happen. So Lawler won a seat that he flipped in 2022 by beating Sean Patrick Maloney, and now is, I guess, on the short list for Republican candidates who might face Governor Hochul in 2026. How does his standing look right now a couple years out?
Well, Lawler's getting some luck here and some breaks his way because potential rivals for the Republican nomination for governor have or could be appointed to the new Trump administration. Lee Zeldin has apparently been in the mix for a cabinet post. Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, another potential candidate for governor, has also been discussed as a potential Trump administration appointee as well. So, and with Stefanik likely going to the United Nations, that really leaves Mike Lawler as probably the most prominent Republican standing in New York at this point. Lawler, of course, is probably going to be thinking about the calculation here that in 2 years' time, that could be a backlash year for Republicans and a good year for Democrats after 2 years of Republicans controlling all branches of government. That could be a setback for the party, and Democrats might be emboldened to come out and vote once again, like they did in 2018. But also, voting patterns could start to be changing in New York as well. So that's going to have to be part of the consideration for Lawler if he decides to actually run. It is still an uphill climb. We saw Zeldin get about 46% of the vote in 2022. That was when Governor Hochul had really only about 13, 14 months to put together her campaign. She's going to have a lot more time and a lot more money in 2026.
Well, Nick Reisman from Politico, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for all of your insights, and I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
You bet.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.